Welcome, everyone, to the Christmas/holiday edition of the Perception in Action podcast. I am Rob Gray from ASU. I'm settled here in front of a roaring fire, nice glass of port, and a big slice of fruitcake to eat. Yum? I'll get to that in a second. I hope you will join me as I share some stories of perception in action in the holiday season.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Christmas Eve and I'm all alone. Can't even get you on the telephone. It's a lonely lit up world without my little girl right by my side.
First up tonight, the bad gift effect. As an ever inquisitive psychologist, one of the things I can't help but doing on Christmas morning is watching the process of emotional self-regulation in action. What I'm referring to is the reaction and re-reaction that typically happens when a person opens a gift they don't really like. Perhaps it's a new sweater knitted by grandma, a DVD box set of something you can watch on Netflix, or a membership to the Moss of the Month Club. That is honestly a real thing. When this occurs, you typically get an immediate, honest emotional reaction, followed by a realization by the gift opener that they are about to seriously offend someone in a process called emotional monitoring. Finally, this typically leads to a quick modification of one's emotions. You know, that fake smile and hopefully not too condescending, "Thanks, I love it." Unless, of course, you have young kids who will just frown, throw it aside, and reach for the next gift. Unfortunately, spotting the unedited, honest emotion is easier for people who you want to like your gifts the most. That is, people you know very, very well, like your spouse. This is similar in an odd way to the use of advanced cues, which I've talked a lot about in the podcast. Through familiarity, you have learned to pick up the really subtle body language cues of the gift opener. Interestingly, the bad gift effect can also be related back to the topic of choking under pressure I discussed in episode 11. Specifically, in 1997, Roy Baumeister proposed that in response to the threat to their ego resulting from high pressure, many athletes feel a lot of emotional distress. That is, they feel anxious and worried about the possibility they're going to be looked at in a bad light and labeled as a choker. These feelings may be so strong that, unlike in my bad gift example, the performer may not be able to effectively modify their emotion through self-regulation. If this occurs, they may resort to trying to get rid of the distress as quickly as possible by making the situation that is causing it, that is the high pressure, go away as quickly as possible. Although this provides some short-term relief, it can lead to the performer rushing through their preparation and/or pre-shot routine and hurrying their skill execution, which of course is likely to make them fail. The desire to self-regulate by rushing will likely get stronger and stronger the longer a performer has to wait before it is their turn to act. A nice example of these effects in soccer penalty shootouts can be seen in a 2009 study by Guy Jourdet and colleagues published in the Psychology of Sport and Exercise. Link in the show notes. Finally, and returning to the idea I started with of modifying one's emotions, in a recent study by Lee Moore and colleagues at Exeter, it was shown that it may be possible to train an athlete to reappraise threatening emotions and instead see the situation as challenging. This can lead to measurable physiological changes and improved performance under pressure. I'll be talking more about this interesting study in the future. Okay, let me pour myself another glass of port and tell you about my second holiday story. Why do people slip on ice?
I try to hold you, but you're like sand, slipping through these broken hands. Oh,
I got the idea for this topic from a post by Andrew Wilson on his and Sabrina Galanka's excellent blog, Notes from Two Scientific Psychologists. Link in the show notes. In his post, Andrew tries to give a solid scientific explanation for why he once slipped on ice and broke his wrist. As I discussed back in episode 15, when talking about hiking, research suggests that when we walk, we prepare each foot movement 2 to 3 steps ahead of time by adjusting the position of our plant foot and the takeoff force. When we can't do this, for example, when our vision is blocked and we can only see 1 step ahead, we must adjust our movements mid-stride, which is less efficient and more prone to error. But obviously, for this 2 to 3 step preparation to work, our visual system needs to be able to reliably detect any obstacles, changes in surface slope, or changes in friction in our environment. This is where the problem comes in with ice. Ideally, what should happen is your perceptual system detects the change in surface friction 2 to 3 steps before you hit the patch of ice, leading to a smooth change in your stride. This doesn't seem to occur, however. In most cases, when people fall on a patch of ice, they walk up to it as if it wasn't there. In other words, there was no change in surface friction. Then when feeling their foot slip, they try to make one of those inefficient mid-stride corrections I just talked about. This results in a loss of balance, and in many situations, like Andrew's, instinctively sticking out one's hand to brace yourself for the fall. In certain countries, this can be a pretty serious problem. For example, in a paper published in Ergonomics in 2004, it was reported that slips on ice account for roughly 40% of the total cost of injuries for elderly people in Sweden in the traffic environment, while in Finland, roughly 23,000 people per year are treated for injuries related to slipping and falling on ice. So the question is, why can't people detect the upcoming change in friction of the road surface 2 to 3 steps ahead of time and appropriately adjust their stride? In a study published in the journal Perception and Psychophysics in 2006, Amy Jo, Karen Adolph, and colleagues investigated how we perceive slipperiness. What they found is that the judgment of slipperiness is primarily based on how shiny a surface appears to be. Here is the problem. How shiny or dull a surface looks is not a good indicator of how slippery it's going to be. Or put more accurately, it's not a good indicator of the coefficient of friction of the surface. For example, many tile floors are shiny but not slippery, while if I poured fine-grained sand on that same floor, it would make it less shiny but more slippery. Joe and colleagues also showed that people's judgments about whether or not they could walk over a surface were affected by things like its color, how far away it was, and how it was lit. Obviously, none of these things actually affect how slippery it will be when you step on it. So watch out when walking around this winter. It is one of the rare occasions where your visual system may be letting you down. Literally.
Ho, ho, ho.
Now on to my final story. First, let me pour out the last little bit of port. Good thing I only drink on the holidays. Wow, I almost said that with a straight face. Before leaving you tonight, I would like to try and solve one of life's great mysteries. Why does everyone hate fruitcake?
Saw you waiting by the cakes and the cookies, and alarm by the beating in my chest. I don't think it was the sugar rushing through my veins.
So why does fruitcake get such a bad rap? Well, part of it is obviously a vicious cycle. No one wants to eat it, so it typically sits around and gets stale for a long time before anyone is brave enough or has indulged in sufficient Christmas cheer to give it a go. But what I want to focus on is its appearance. Who in the world came up with the idea of putting fluorescent, radioactive-looking material that is the green and red candied fruit on top? Seriously, it's so bright you could land a plane by it. In a really interesting series of studies, one of my collaborators, Charles Spence from the University of Oxford, has been investigating the impact of food color on a perception of taste and flavor. For those that might be interested, I would recommend his review article published in the journal Flavor in 2015. Link again in the show notes. Color has been shown to be the single most important perceptual cue in terms of setting our expectations about what we're about to eat, which in turn can have a dramatic effect on the flavor once we dig in. As Charles states in his article, quote, color creates a psychological expectation for a certain flavor that is often impossible to dislodge, unquote. The most basic effect found is that people expect foods that have a more intense color to have a more intense flavor. So the candied fruit on top of fruitcake probably makes us think we're about to eat 100 limes covered in hot pepper sauce. Actually, research has shown that the addition of red and green colors makes us more sensitive to the bitterness and sourness in food respectively. Again, yum, pass me another piece. There's also been some evidence, although it's not entirely consistent, showing that when the taste does not match with the expectations generated by the color, it can produce what is called a negative valence effect, resulting in less satisfaction with the food. It's really hard to overstate how strong this effect of color on taste is. In a fascinating study/anecdote published in 1973, Wheatley had participants eat a steak dinner under dim lighting. Halfway through the meal, which all seemed to be enjoying up to that point, he turned up the lights to reveal that the steak had been dyed blue, the chips were dyed green, and the peas were dyed red. This resulted in several participants feeling ill and rushing to the bathroom. So returning to that neglected fruitcake you're trying to get rid of, my professional advice is try picking off the candied fruits and seeing if that helps. Or you could just put it out on your front porch. It's a lot cheaper and easier than hanging Christmas lights. From the Perception in Action podcast, have a safe and happy holiday season.
Deck the halls with boughs of holly. Tis the season to be jolly. Don we now our bright apparel.
Remember, you can head to perceptionaction.com to find out everything about this podcast, including the show notes, some info about me, different ways you can listen, what's coming in future episodes, and ways to contact me. This is Rob Gray from ASU. Cheers for now.